Welcome back, everybody, to the Ag Aviator Podcast. Sorry, it has been a minute. Busy with fertilizer this spring. Haven't been too busy with spray season, so luckily I was able to get a hold of Peter Schellenberger today. We're going to sit down and talk about his experience in the ag aviation world, along with the firebombing and some forestry work he's done. We'll also get into a few incident stories we'd like to share with you guys and kind of talk about how this season is going. So, with that, the Ag Aviator Podcast spools up now. Of course, we got to give a shout out to our sponsor, American Designs. American Designs is started by a friend of mine, Travis Sum, who's an egg pilot building parts for egg pilots. If you're looking for some air tractor steps, a set of mirrors, a visor, or a smoker oil fill cap in anodized aluminum, you just go ahead, get a hold of Travis. You can run over to his website, americandesigns.com. That's Alpha Mike Bravo, E-R-I-C-A-N designs.com. Travis is also in the process of building the one-stop shop for egg aviation parts online. So head over to American Designs and see what he has in stock for you there. And today I am joined by Peter Schellenberger. Peter, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm doing great. Doing great. Could be busier, but hey, like I said earlier, we're getting to report a podcast, so we are doing something.
Yes, sir.
So, Peter, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, and then maybe a little on how you got interested in ag aviation and how you got into the industry.
All right. Well, I'm originally from Douglas, Wyoming, born and raised. I left Wyoming when I was about 19, moved out to Illinois, which is where my wife is from, and we had met at college, so I moved out here to be near her. I started taking flying lessons, saw my first crop duster, and my instructor turns to me and goes, that guy's going to make $100,000 before a year's over. Right then I thought, well, now that's the job for me, you know. So that was when I kind of got that harebrained idea to do, be a crop duster. After that, that was pretty much all I pursued at that point. A couple months later, I decided to try to get a job on the ground, doing ground work, loading, mixing, fueling, all that kind of stuff. And I got a job down in central Arkansas. I wanted to go somewhere south because they have a longer season. So I got a job down there and worked at a rice operation on the ground for 2 years. Meanwhile, I finished up my private instrument commercial and wasn't really looking for an ag seat at that moment. I kind of steered off that route and kind of was headed towards the corporate route. I just, you know, the drive to go fly and to be paid to fly took over, and I found somebody who put me in an airplane and started my first season. Well, I guess it would have been spring of 2018 was when I started my first season in Kansas. That's kind of the short version of it. You know, there's a lot more that was involved, but like I said, I wasn't really seeking an ag seat at the time. It just kind of was made available, and really it was my drive to just get out there and go fly. I wanted to go fly and get paid to do it, and that's kind of what drove me to it. And then once I got into it, you know, I love it. So
gotcha.
I would say that's how I got in.
So would you say you said that you were kind of leaning towards the corporate side of things? Are you glad that your journey went the direction it did and you're not doing that? Do you think you definitely made a good decision going with ag?
Up until the spring of 2020, I was not thinking really that. But then after the all-famous corona hit, I have never been more happy that I made that decision to go with ag, because as like everybody knows, I mean, it really hit everybody, except for crop dusters and farmers, because everybody's got to eat. So yeah, I would say I'm 100% glad that I made that decision. Granted, I would still like the opportunity to be able to do some corporate work in the future, just to be able to go fly some jets. But really, that would just be something in the wintertime. But yeah, I'm very glad I made that decision.
Yeah, I think we all really appreciated the fact that we chose the ag route. It was pretty tough seeing a lot of people, a lot of college classmates that decided to go towards that corporate side or go to airlines, obviously be out of work. We're pretty fortunate to be in the line of work that we're in. Why don't we go into a little bit more detail on how exactly that you got into the industry? So you said you were thinking about going one direction, but then this opportunity kind of popped up right in front of you. Was that while you were doing the groundwork?
Yes, it was, I guess it would have been spring of 2018. I was trying to get my CFI done, and the operation I worked for did a little bit of timber work, and I drove their semi. I play CDL, and so I was hauling a hopper bottom and hauling a fuel tanker. And so I wasn't able to finish my CFI. I pretty much had a job lined up to be a full-time CFI and pretty much transitioned into a jet part-time, but it was contingent on getting the CFI. Well, I was busy working my job, wasn't able to finish the CFI. They filled the spot, and so now here I am left with not much of a promise for employment at this place. So that's when I was like, well, I got to fly. And I was looking at a couple options. One was a sightseeing pilot up in Maine, a sightseeing / glider pilot, which would have afforded me some pretty cool airplane time, like a Waco and a couple other airplanes. But and I was fully prepared to do it. The guy apparently didn't think I could do it or something like that. And for some reason, it fell through the cracks. And then I never looked for an operator in Arkansas who was ready to hire a newbie. I guess maybe I didn't have the faith that anybody would, you know, put me in anything. So I never really looked. So I was like, well, I got to find somebody who put me in a piston because, you know, nobody's going to start me in a turbine.
Yep.
And that was tough, really tough. And of course there's not a lot of pistons in Arkansas. I know there might be a couple, but anyway, a friend of mine, my mentor, he's kind of a mentor, father figure, and he was a pilot at the flying service I worked at. He knew a guy, helped a guy up in Kansas who had, four airplanes, three turbines and one radial 301. And he said, hey, call this gentleman, Bill Garrison. He said, call him. He might be looking for a 301 pilot. So I called this guy out of nowhere. And, told him my situation. He goes, well, he's like, what are you, he thought I was looking for a turbine ticket. I said, well, no, I said, I was hoping that maybe I could help you out and maybe fly your radio 301. You know, I was trying to be as humble as I could and not presume anything. Which I believe is a really important part if you're wanting to get a job.
Absolutely.
You gotta really be, like, stay as humble as you can and don't expect anything of anybody. And so I asked him and he said, well, you need to get the applicator's test done. I said, okay. So, I scheduled it, which was up in Kansas, and I drove up there 8 hours and took the test, went and met with him. And apparently that was a big deal to him that I just made the effort to just even go up there just to take the test. You know?
Yep.
And so I went out, met with him. He could, you know, he showed me around. We talked and he said, well, you know, if you're going to come up here, he's like, I'd like you to stay a while as a pilot, you know? And so I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have to move up here. You know, I'm going to have to leave Arkansas, which at this point I had already fallen in love with Arkansas and I love it down there. And even though I'm not from there, it's like home to me. So that was a big deal, you know, to do that.
Yep.
And, I think every operator is looking when somebody like new is wanting to get in. I feel like they're wanting to see that new person want to put some skin in the game. And for me at that point, that was my skin in the game, was moving up there,
yep.
Moving my whole family, my new baby and my wife, moving them up there. and leaving someplace I loved to someplace that, I'll be honest with you, Kansas isn't the best place to live, in my opinion, but it gets a little windy there.
Yeah.
So anyway, me and my wife talked about it, we prayed about it, and we thought, you know what, this is my only shot at flying right now, because I couldn't find anybody else. And I wanted to do it so bad that I picked up and moved. And we moved up there. That's pretty much how I got my first seat. And the thing about it was, is I did not have a lot of time. I think I maybe had 350 hours total time, and not very much tailwheel, maybe 100 some hours tailwheel.
Yep.
And he still hired me. And, you know, he paid for me to go, do some training in a radial airplane. It was a T-6, a North American T-6, which was crazy for me because I was like, you know, that's a Warbird. I've never got to fly one of those, you know, but because it had the same motor and it was a big tailwheel.
Yep.
He had me go do it. And one thing I realized at that point was get somebody to like you enough. There's no limit. I believe there's no limit to what they'll do to make you qualified for insurance, you know, right, or make you qualified to work for them. I guess that's really how I got my first seat. And I mean, you know, go on through the season, you know, he just kind of, he had me taxi around a little bit, and then I flew it for the first time. And then of course, like radials all do, I flew it one time, and the next time I went to fly it, it was broke, and yeah, didn't get to fly it for another 3 weeks. And had to work on it and pull a starter off, which I'm telling you, it took me six hours to pull six nuts off and get that starter out. I have no patience. I have no patience working on airplanes.
But, yeah, yeah. You don't like wrenching, you're flying the wrong airplane there.
I learned that right off the bat.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Well, that's pretty cool. I'd imagine that flying the T-6 definitely prepared you for the 301. I mean, that is definitely a bigger, heavier tailwheel airplane.
Yes. Yeah, it was. The T-6 is a phenomenal airplane and a lot of fun. And for me, at that point, the biggest tailwheel I'd flown was a 170. Most of my tailwheel time was in a Champ.
Yep.
And so getting into that big airplane, and my instructor was a really good instructor. In fact, he's one of the pilots on the B-29 there at Wichita Doc.
Okay.
So he's very, very accomplished, very, very good pilot. And so he trained me well, and you know, we got to spin it, we got to do all kinds of stuff, and it was quite fun, you know, to be able to do that.
You've flown Ag a couple years now. Still love what you're doing every day. Hasn't gotten old on you?
No, I still love it. And, you know, and I haven't been doing it very long. I wish I had been doing it longer. That's just the card that I dealt. But, you know, so I don't want to come off as cocky. But I'm thankful to be able to do it. You know, I don't know. I guess I can tell you about this, but recently I had a bad car wreck back in February. That laid me up for, I guess I'm going on 4 months now, just a little over 4 months. And I had a bad ankle dislocation on my left ankle, and I had come home for 2 weeks for a 2 week break from timber, and that wreck happened. So I would definitely say at this point, I'm very thankful for my job, thankful to be able to fly. And when I go back, I will definitely love it more than I did, you know, before my accident. You know, absence makes the heart grow fonder. And that would definitely be the case with flying. When you sit out for 4 months and you don't get to fly, it'll really change your attitude towards it and make you really appreciate the job and make you really love it. And I tell you this right now, even when I go back, even on those bumpy, rough, hot days, I'm still going to be thankful for it. I'm still going to love it because you never know when that time may come where you may not be able to fly. It's such a huge privilege to be able to do what we do, and such a huge freedom just to be able to fly, and then throw in that the crop dusting side of it. Yeah, I love it. I love it. And if I can, you know, if the good Lord wills it, I would love to do it until I get old, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You know, perspective is everything. And like we were talking about, before we started the podcast, I mean, even all winter long, I'm screwing off. It's like you go snowmobiling and I could easily hurt myself. And I don't know a lot of other egg pilots that think about it that hard. Like, oh yeah, if I hurt myself bad enough in the off season, I'm out of work. And, you know, not only do you not get to do what you love, but unfortunately, this is not a salaried paid leave kind of job. I mean, you get paid by the acre, and if you ain't spraying acres, you ain't getting paid. And it's, I really appreciate the kind of sentimental point of view you have on it, because I think I'd feel exactly the same way. I mean, even this season with how bad our drought has been and not being able to fly hardly at all at home, I mean, I would kill to have a day that I started at sunrise and ended at sunset. It just, I mean... Yeah. Not turning a prop for weeks on end, it's brutal, but I can't imagine just being laid up and not have anything to do with it. So thanks for giving us that perspective, and I hope everybody thinks about it a little bit. So you really haven't been doing this all too long, but you've got a couple other irons in the fire too. So, you know, it sounds like the operations you've worked at, or the operation you do work out, does some timber work. And you know what? I do not know a lot of pilots that have had the opportunity to do timber work. So could you kind of tell us a little bit about the differences between doing timber work and doing, normal egg flying, or is it pretty similar?
There's some similarities. Before I started working for the operation I work at, when I was in Kansas, everything was wet. There was no dry work, very little dry work. So I'm used to flying low level, and, you know, you're trying to get down and get as close. At AAA standards, you know, 10 to 12 feet, you know, even though sometimes we have to get a little bit lower than that sometimes. But I'm used to that sort of flying. When I went to my current employer, he started me out on cover crop, which is pretty much the same thing as timber or forestry fertilizing, you know, as far as height-wise. You know, you're flying high. So you're not having to worry so much about obstacles like you would when you're down low. So it compares a little bit to ag flying as far as that goes, as far as your height, like you'd be doing with your fertilizer, you know, rice or corn or whatever.
Yep.
But honestly, there's some other big differences, though, is, you know, with timber. Timber is so easy. It's easy work as far as the actual work part of it. You're working off of fairly good-sized municipal airports. It's usually during the winter, so you don't have long 14-hour, 14-and-a-half-hour flight days. You're looking at, like, maybe a 10-hour day. It's a pretty decent day, yep. Pretty long day, just because of the sunlight. And we don't really fly much past dark or much past sundown because unfamiliar area usually, and it's trees. You don't have hardly any options if something goes wrong, and it's dark or, you know, low light.
Right.
I have a new helmet this year, and I got a second visor that I snap on because I don't like the big bulky dual visor, but it's a low light visor. And that really helps. And it'll give you probably an extra 35 minutes of daylight at the end of the day, which is real helpful sometimes. But so it's a little bit different from ag flying in that respect, as far as, you know, the airports you work off of. Another big difference between timber and crop dusting, or, you know, ag flying, is you have no visual reference as far as east, north, west. You know, there are no roads to go by.
Yep.
So you are strictly flying the light bar and your GPS. You'll pull up, we have polys. You know, they'll show up on our map or on a computer, and we hit our enter poly pattern,
yep.
Which will bring up an automatic AB, and we just, you know, I set it up a quick track X usually, which, you know, is a predetermined number of swaths, yep. And you just set it up, and I'll circle my plot. I mean, where I see the airplane on my screen going around. I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess this looks like a plot here. And sometimes you kind of see one border, maybe.
Yep.
Like if some of the trees are a little younger. But then you go and swing out there, make a nice wide turn, and make it real gentle. So that way you got lots of room, because you go to roll out on that light bar, and you're like, wait, I have no idea where the field's at. And so you really, it'll really sharpen your light bar skills.
Yeah, you really got to start following those dots.
Yeah, very much. And so you get on that, and the nice, one of the easy parts about the job is it's all hydraulic automatic gate.
Okay.
So you set it to auto in out on your gate controller, and you just have a rocker switch down there. You hit your rocker switch on, or, you know, when you first start the field, you'll cross the field boundary, and the little lights will kind of make that little mini umbrella.
Yep.
And as soon as they touch in the middle, you flip that rocker on, and it'll kick the gate open, and it'll start fertilizing. And when you hit the end of the poly on the other end, it'll sense when you're getting, like, I think it's 1.2 seconds from the end, and it'll automatically shut the gate off, and you just keep flying, you know, and go make your turn. So that part is really easy.
So I take it you're using a Satlock system for this?
Yeah, a G4. It'd be a G4, Satlock G4.
Yeah, I did not realize how useful my G4 was until I was just in Wyoming basically doing similar work, except it was liquid. And there was a lot of things my G4 did that I didn't know were so useful, and that's exactly it. I wasn't using auto boom, but where we were at, you've got a pile of polys in front of you, but absolutely zero borders and no good way to make an AB line. So I had to figure out the same enter poly pattern, and then and using that little umbrella. I didn't even know my light bar did that. I never even paid attention to it, and all of a sudden it was the most useful thing compared to some of the other guys that are using different systems, because I could keep my head outside of the cockpit the whole time. I didn't have to look inside and be like, okay, is there a skip between this poly and that? My light bar would just be like, shut off and turn on and shut off. And it was pretty useful.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is incredible, all of the features that they have on there. And there's so much more that we don't know that it'll do, you know. In fact, I had a G4 in that 301 that I started in. And, at first, I was like, I have no idea what that is. I was like, maybe that's a reward for staying on swath perfectly. You know, maybe it's like, okay, here's your reward. It's these pretty lights. You know, I had no idea what it was.
Yep. Yeah, I know. And this is no plug for Satlock. They didn't sponsor it, but thumbs up. It's a pretty good product. I think they're coming out with a new one this year. We'll see. It's a. I had that AgNav last year, and it was an all right system. But this G4, I definitely got it. And, you know, anybody that's used the Satlock their whole life, you're like, how the heck do you navigate around this thing? And they're like, oh, come on, you know, enter poly this, set waypoint this. And as soon as you get the pattern and the cadence of everything down, it's actually pretty simple. The Timber, are you doing this in an 802?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there are. It's all 802s.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I didn't say this at the beginning, but me and Peter met at the 2019 National Convention at Speed Mentoring. We sat at the same table together. But I think if I remember correctly, you flew the 301. You were in a 402, correct, for a while?
Yeah, a 400, pretty much clip wing 402, yeah.
Okay, gotcha. So from there, did you move on to the 802?
Yeah, it was kind of a broken up transition. I didn't go directly into one. Yeah, I flew the 400 for two seasons, and like before I started my third season, the 400 went and got my, it's like your type rating exemption letter, and so that way you don't have to have a type rating.
Okay.
Even though the 802 grosses at 16,000 pounds.
Right.
You know, so it's over 12.5, but. Anyway, I went and got that. There's a couple different ways to get it. I got mine through a certified air tractor ground instructor, like an 802 ground instructor.
Okay.
And so anyway, but yeah, I did that. And then I was fortunate enough to meet a couple people who did Timber, and they had a two-holer, dual control two-holer 802. And I drove down there on my own, not getting paid, and stayed for about a week or 10 days out of Louisiana, and I flew the 802 backseat with them. The only problem was it was February, and January, February in the South is awful. The weather is terrible. So out of the 10 days I was there, I think I flew a total of like maybe 30 hours, which was just barely enough to qualify me for the flyers.
Okay.
For the firebombing, but the 802, that was when I kind of done it, was kind of halfway through my 400 season, was when I got the 802.
I may have the opportunity to fly an 802 in the future, and I'm flying a 402, so pretty darn similar to the 400. So what kind of challenges did you face moving from the 400 up to the 802? Was it a fairly big learning curve, or was it just a bigger air tractor?
Yes. Some of that I would agree with. Honestly, when you get it up in the air and you start working it or flying it around, it's a big 402.
Yeah.
I mean, it really, if it's rigged right and everything, you know, the first one I flew solo had the VGs on it, which really, that works really well. Makes it real stable, slow speeds and stuff. But rigged right and everything, it's a lot like a big 402, just really big and heavy and tall. It's like going from, it'd be like going from driving a Honda Civic to driving a Peterbilt.
Yeah.
is what it's like, and a lot faster.
Yep.
So in respect to a 402, I would say it handles a lot the same when you're like flying it, just a lot more power. So you could just, I really learned a lot about that when I started actually working one. Cause in the fire world, you don't really work it. You just kind of lollygag, cause you're trying to be careful.
Yep.
We try to be careful in ag too, but in ag, you're trying to get turned around and go back to the field. Well, I kind of had to learn that, can't just pull that thing through a flat turn very easily because you just got so much power.
Yep.
Even at a lower power setting, I'm used to seeing 1,200 pounds of torque.
Right.
And then you go to the 802 and working pound torque is like 3,200 pounds.
Yep.
So quite a big difference.
Yeah.
So there's a big difference there. And the speed is a lot different too. At first, when I started flying it, I was afraid to get it slow because you just, in the 400, you feel like you're strapping an airplane on you.
Yeah.
In the 802, you feel like you're getting into a big airplane. Like,
right.
It just feels huge when you get into it. The cockpit is huge. And so you it's scary when you get down there to the, 80 mile an hour, which isn't that slow, when you're landing.
Yeah.
And so, I remember when I first started, it was like I was bringing it in, 95, 100 mile an hour, which is fast.
Yeah.
That's fast for that thing. So it took a while to just get used to the speed and get comfortable with pulling the power back and slowing it up and bringing it in nice and slow. And you could make a real nice, smooth 3-point or wheel or whatever landing.
Okay.
And honestly, the first time I landed it, I think they land fairly easy just because they're heavy, so they don't really like to bounce. Now I've had my fair share of bounces in them.
Yep.
But if you kind of get a little bit slow and but you're not very high off the ground, it'll just kind of settle in. It's got lots of weight, real heavy.
Yep.
So as far as differences, it's somewhat like the 402, but in other ways, it was a little bit different too, as far as size and speed. And it was took some getting used to the starting and everything, because that 67 motor, it's so slow. It takes forever to wind up when you're starting. And so that just, kind of takes some patience.
Right. I've kind of wondered about that myself because I'm flying a Dash 11 402. So, I'm same thing. 1,200 foot-pounds is about my max working torque. And you really got to milk that 1,200 pounds out for a while before you're light enough that you're actually starting to gain some altitude in your turns and you're getting a little fast coming in and pulling power back. And I kind of wondered about the 802 because my employer has one. And I just watched him when we're out working together. And I'm like, gosh, he gets... it obviously he makes a very safe turn, but he gets a lot of altitude out of the turn. And I'm like, what? I'm like, gosh, you really get up there in a turn. And he's like, really? I don't really feel like it. But, he's been turning the thing for 3-4 years now. But, you can't pull the power back to an idle to make a flat Cessna turn, but you gotta, sure it's a balance there.
It is. Yeah, that's one of the frustrating things about this business that, like, I've talked about this with my wife a lot, and like, there's such a fine line, you know, like the line represents taking your time,
yep.
you know, like we're all supposed to do. And then on one side of the line is lollygagging, and then on the other side of the line is, you know, going too fast, or
right.
like the last pass letter, you know, aggressive, you know, being aggressive, you know.
Yep.
It's so hard to ride that line
yeah.
and have self-control.
So I guess let's talk a little bit about fire now. Last year you got carded. Could you tell us a little bit about what being carded means and what it took for you to get carded so you could fight fires?
Yeah, it's kind of like everything else that I've gotten to do. It kind of fell in my lap, and I really was not intending to do it. I guess it would have been right before we met at the convention.
Okay.
My good buddy and mentor, who I referred to earlier, he calls me up and he goes, "Hey man, you want to go to fire school?" And he had been flying fires in Abilene, Texas. And he said, "You want to go to fire school?" And I thought, well, yeah, why not? Sure. You know, I didn't know what it entailed, but you know, they say yes and then learn how to do it later. So I said, yeah. At that point, I had considered the fire bombing, and I thought, well, I want to try to get some more, or I think I'll get some more ag time in, and then I'll try to push it. You know, maybe I just didn't think anybody would take me, and of course, I had no 802 time.
Yeah.
So this kind of fell in my lap, and I said, well, you know what? Sure. You know, these people seem to know what they're doing, so they think I can do it, then I'll go for it. So he put me in contact with one of their company guys, who helped me get sponsored. You got to get sponsored to go to NAFA, which is National Aerial Firefighting Academy, NAFA 1, and that's in Tucson. You got to get somebody to sponsor you there, and then they make their selections. I think they have like selections based on the state, per state, so many selections per state. Anyway, I got selected. You go to NAFA. I flew down to NAFA January 4th or 5th or something like that, and flew down to Tucson, and it's about a week-long school. You go in there, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. You get to meet people from literally all over the world, Australia. There's people from Canada there. There's just a lot of cool people, and you train with, like, a variety of different types of pilots and different jobs in the firefighting industry. There's people who fly the VLATs, which would be the, you know, the DC-10s and the 747 Super Tanker or whatever. People who fly the helicopters, people who are not pilots, that they actually do the coordinating, the air attack. There's all kinds of people there. You go through the school. They do lots of scenarios and stuff where you have to learn the radio mumbo jumbo, you know, to talk on the radio. And they do a sandbox where they simulate where a fire would be at. You have little toy airplanes, which is fun. It's fun for me.
Yeah.
Go out in the parking lot, and they have, you know, they have arrows with, you know, a fire designated by tape on the parking lot. And then they practice, you know, somebody's air attack, and then they have a couple feet, you know, single engine air tankers. They have those, you know, one guy will be one, and then another guy will be another, and then somebody else will be a helicopter. Anyway, you go and you train, you learn all this stuff. You learn about what it's like to, you know, work on a fire. Some of it's specific to, you know, the seat pilots. Some of it's more specific to the helicopter pilots. And you go through it. You get a certification at the end, a certificate saying you completed NAFA 1. And then at the end of that was when I got my 802 typewriting letter or typewriting exemption letter,
okay.
Which legally got me to where I could fly 802. And I got that while I was down there with an instructor. After that, came back home where I was at Kansas, and then we got ready to do our company training. I was sponsored by M&M Air Service out of Beaumont, Texas. You know, they hold their company training every year just like any other company. And so we go to company training March, actually, because it was literally, we got done the day that everything shut down for Corona.
Okay.
So we got down there. That was like my last normal trip ever. And I get down there and we start doing our company training. It's about 3 days. And we go through a big binder of stuff, and you we go out, and that was the first time I actually did drops and stuff, water drops with an 802. I had flown the 802 prior to that between Napa and training. I was when I went and did my 802 flying and got my 25 hours or 25 plus hours. And so we went to company training, did some water drops. You do some more, you watch some videos, you talk to, there's some Texas Forest Service guys there. And there was an air attack guy there talking to us. And then they have a guy come in, Department of Interior, he comes in, flew his bonanza in there, and he goes, okay, there's these towers north of Abilene. He's like, show me your sectional chart. He shows them. He's like, I want you to tell me, I want you to figure out the coordinates to that, and I want you to tell me what heading and distance it is from here. And you go and you find that out. You know, you might have to do some coordinate conversions, and you figure that out. And then, of course, you put on your flight suit and your helmet. You got to have your flight gloves and everything. It's government work, so it's very, very, everything is very safety involved, safety oriented. I mean, yes. He takes you out to the airplane. You sit in the airplane with it off. You turn your master on and you get your helmet on and you get your, it'd be your tactical radio. The stuff, it looks like it's out of a Top Gun movie. I mean, it's crazy looking radio. And he's sitting down there with a handheld one, and you bring yours up, and you, he'll give you frequencies that you got to program into the radio, which isn't hard. You follow the directional videos off of YouTube. It's very easy. And you key up on the mic, and you call him up, and he responds to you. So I told him, you know, my distance and heading to this, these towers and a couple other things. And he said, okay, you're good to go. And you fire up, taxi over across the airport, get loaded up with water, and then, you know, go take off. And it was there at the Big Abilene Airport. They had tower. The tower there is very helpful. They're very accommodating. And so they gave us pretty much one half of the airport to do our drops and stuff.
Nice.
And he tells you, I want one full load of the marker, and then you land, get another load. He's like, no, I want a split load. And then you come in and you split it. So you, it would be called, I think it's a roll up to, so you start and you roll up to your target. And so that splits it, you know, so it was 600 gallons. I think I was only taking 600 gallons. So 300 gallons, and I'd roll it up to the marker. I'd go back around, and then I do a tag and extend, which is tagging on to your last drop and extending it. And that starts at the marker and going out. And you want to overlap rather than leave a gap.
Right.
So I overlapped a little bit much, but it's better to have an overlap than a gap. The air attack's never going to yell at you for overlapping a little bit too much, because now there's not, you know, there's no hole that has to be filled. So you do that. Then you do an emergency dump, which would be full, you know, salvo, where everything goes at once. Come back around, land. Kind of have a debrief with the examiner, and he gives you your card and says, you know, he writes you your card. It's a little pilot card, and it says what aircraft type, and it'll have your company name, it'll have your name, and the date, and then expiration, and what level seat pilot you are. There's two levels. There's a one and a two, and I'm a two, because I'm the less experienced, you know, no real live drops under my belt.
So okay.
It's level two. And that lasts for a year, and level two pilots have to recard every year. And I think level one is every 3 years, I think. Yeah, I think it's every 3 years. So you do that, get your card, and then I went home, you know, and went back to crop dusted, and, you know, and I really was, you know, I told him, I said, I'm full-time crop dusted job, so I don't know how much time I'm going to have to do any fires. Later in the year, I was on corn run, and they were calling me saying, hey, you know, can you fill in for a pilot? Because usually it's either 10 days on or 2 days off, or 12 on, two off, something like that. And so those 2 days that full-time pilot is off, they need a relief pilot to man the airplane, you know, in case they get called out, which they usually do.
Okay.
So at the time I was busy. Well, end of August comes up. I put my 2 weeks in with my boss because I'm fixing to go work for my new employer in Arkansas. And I ended up, my boss just told me, he said, well, he's like, you might as well just go ahead and leave right now rather than stay around 2 weeks. He's like, you might as well just go ahead and leave. That way, you know, it'll give you time to prepare for your next adventure is what he said. You know, he was very gracious about it. You know, we had a good relationship. So that ended up freeing me up. And literally that night, they called me and said, hey, we need you in Brinkley, Arkansas tomorrow morning, which is an 8-hour drive. And they're like, we need you down there to pick up a fire bomber and get out to Abilene. I mean, right now, be there at 8 o'clock tomorrow. Or you got to be there by noon tomorrow. You know? So I'm scrambling, packing my bags. And I'm like, I got to go. And my wife is pregnant at the time, fixing to have a baby in about 2 weeks.
Oh boy.
So, you know, and I'm getting ready to move and I'm getting ready to start a new job and all this, you know, and so the pressure's on. And of course, up until this point, I was pretty nervous about the fires just because everybody I talked to and everything I heard about it, everybody had hyped it up that it was just so scary. And you're talking on the radio, you're dealing with the federal government and all this. And you don't want to get your, card pulled, you know, because some of those air attacks are really rude and the sticklers. So I was nervous. And so when they called me, I'm like, it was kind of one of those things, I'm excited to do it. Finally, I get to do it. But it's like, oh, man, I don't know if I can do this. You know, this is going to be tough. I got my stuff packed up. I went down to Arkansas and picked up the airplane and flew it out to Abilene and ended up getting all the contract stuff taken care of and check in. And they want to look at your airplane, and there's, like you said, you know, government, lots of regulations. And so they're required to check this and check that and sign this. And I'm sitting there waiting to go on contract, and one of the other pilots, like, I'm sitting there, like, day two, and I'm like, man, this, you know, this sucks. I want to get on contract so I start getting paid. Well, that afternoon, two of the seats went out. One of them was the company, I guess maybe both of them were, and they went out, and on their way back, one of them took a bird through the right side window, and, you know, he was okay, everything was okay, he made landed safely. Well, I'm sitting there going, I mean, that's too bad, that's terrible, but I started putting two and two together. I'm like, they're going to put my airplane on, because this airplane will be down for the next day, you know, until they get a new window.
Yep.
So, sure enough, they're like, okay, you're going on contract tomorrow morning. So, 8 a.m., you better be ready. So, it's like, oh, man, you know, time to get going. So, next day, we get out there, and firebombing is very easy. It's really easy work. I got a good friend of mine who does it full-time, and we were talking about it. And he goes, you know, it's banker hours, because you show up at 8 o'clock, and you pretty much don't do anything until you don't fly probably until around 2 o'clock. I mean, there's some times where they'll go out in the morning, but usually they don't like to call the seats out until, you know, around 2 o'clock or so. So that way they don't burn up all the time on the seats early in the morning when they can actually use them in the afternoon.
Yep.
So sometimes the fire already be going in the morning and they won't call the seats out until 2 o'clock. They get you on out there. You show up, check your airplane out, make sure it's fueled, check your oil, and you go to the morning briefing where the Texas Forest Service guys would be there, the pit manager or the pit boss and stuff. And fortunately, we had an air attack that was based at Abilene at the time. So he was there and the air attack pilot. So you all get together with the other seat pilots as well, and you meet and talk about this and that and the plan of action. They go through the haze index, which is like different things, talking about the combustibility of the fuel out there today. You know, is it a high, kind of a high fire danger or a low fire danger? You know, what's the wind speed, temperature, humidity, all that stuff. So they do that, and then you go do paperwork up in the air conditioned FBO, and you go to lunch, and then come back after lunch, and you lay down at the chair upstairs and just kind of relax, try to catch a nap. But you're nervous because you know that phone is going to ring sometime that afternoon. The phone's going to ring and it's going to be time to go. And you got 15 minutes to get out there, get your airplane fired up and go get a load and be taxiing out ready for takeoff.
Yep.
And so it's nerve wracking, you know, because you know what's going to happen. So you don't get any sleep.
Yeah.
And inevitably the phone rings and each airplane has a driver and a truck and a trailer for each airplane because it's government work.
Yep.
Everything, you know, and you call your driver and be like, hey, we got a dispatch coming in or a D-board, what they call it. Get the airplane ready. I'm on my way out. And they'll have everything pulled off, ready to go and stowed. And all you got to do is go out, get in and fire up and, you know, go down to the pit. You go down there, you know, and it's all pretty simple. You just talk to them on the radio and say, hey, I think it was 856 or whatever, cleared into the pit. Yeah, cleared into pit one. And they pull you in and tell you when to stop and load you up. They give you your little piece of paper. You enter your coordinates and all that and verify the heading and distance, you know, and make sure all that's right. And it's quite an overload at first. And to be honest with you, the first three or four drops, I was terrified and I absolutely hated it because it was just like gut wrenching. Like you're just, I mean, you're so tight and tense and scared and it's 105 degrees out. So you're just sweating,
right?
You know, sweating from the stress and from the heat.
Yep.
So you go out there and fortunately the first three or four fires, I had a more experienced level two. He had probably 30 drops or so. So he had done a few fires. I was following him and we were a flight of two. So he would handle radio communications right up until he made his drop. And then, you know, AirAttac would start talking to me. And, then I would deal with AirAttac one-on-one after that. So it was very difficult at first, or so I thought. And then once you make your drop, the most harrowing moments, I think, are the few seconds right after you make your drop and there's no radio. And then you hear AirAttac come up and they say, you know, take rate 5-6, good line, good drop, load return, you know, Abilene or whatever.
Yep.
And when you hear those words, that's just, oh, that makes your day. And you're like, I did a good job.
Yep.
And then from then on, you're starting to get in the groove and you know, go back, get another load and do it over. But, you know, like I said, it's really easy work. And, you know, you need to be good with radio communications, comfortable really, I guess, with radio communications. But it's really not all that hard. It's not all that everybody's hyped it up to be.
Yeah.
But it's cool. It's kind of cool to be the hero, which I mean, you're not trying to be the hero, but as a firefighter plane, you're kind of viewed as, hey, they're coming to save these houses or save whatever,
yeah,
save the forest, rather than the crop dust, the blankety blank crop duster who keeps waking me up every morning.
Right.
That was cool. That was a cool part of it.
You go from the guy that's being shot at to the guy that's being cheered for.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, appreciate you sharing that about fire with us. I've really wanted to get somebody from the fire side on here, and I'm glad you kind of had the pretty diverse range of things that you've been able to do already and share that. So far this 2021 season, we have seen, I don't want to say above average fatalities, obviously the year isn't over yet, but before we really haven't hit the busy season of the year. I talked about this in my podcast with Matt Pete a little bit about, you know, the busiest part of the year really starts kind of after the 4th of July, really around the country, especially with the corn run in the central Midwest and just kind of everywhere. I mean, even up in North Dakota, that is kind of our busy part of the season too. So it's a very unsettling feeling that we've already had this many fatalities in the 2021 season. And there's a lot of opportunity left for more. Obviously we don't want to see that. And thoughts and prayers to all those in the industry who have lost someone this year. We're thinking about you and praying for you. I'm going to set Peter up here for kind of a question on what he does to keep his head in the game. I'm going to talk just briefly a little bit about kind of how my career has gone thus far. Obviously, this is only my third season. To keep my head in the game from being aggressive or from getting complacent, I guess, you know, my first season, I think like a lot of people, your first season is just nerve-wracking. It's very new to you. You're an inexperienced pilot. Getting used to, you don't realize how busy ag flying is until your first season. I mean, you can sit on the ground and dream about it, but it is very overwhelming at first. And I guess for me, from my experience, that made me cautious. It made me not want to be macho. It made me, it didn't make me invincible. It made me, it forced me to be careful, it seemed like, because I knew I didn't know what I was doing very well, and I just kind of held off. And then same thing in that second season. Last year, I was in a new operation. I was flying a turbine for the first year. You know, you're dealing with the turbine engine. You're being cautious about that, learning how that responds. You're flying a lot faster than you do in a Cessna or a 301. And all that new stuff, it kind of kept me cautious and kept me in that mindset of like, hey, just take it easy and learn the job. Learn how to do the job. Don't feel like you need to get work done. Just learn how to do the job. And same thing that towards the end of the year when I got comfortable with the airplane, well, then we started our burn down herbicide season. And it was like, okay, now you have to learn how to pay very close attention to your application while still flying the airplane safely. And it seemed like right at the beginning of this third season, I remember I was about to go do my first load of CRP herbicide. And I was like, okay, so what's making me cautious this year? So nothing's new now. You know, there isn't anything big that's new. You've flown this airplane before. You're comfortable in it. You're comfortable doing herbicide now. What is going to keep me in that safe mindset of, you know, obviously, let's do this job. Let's do it correctly. Let's do it as efficiently as possible. But first priority is coming home at the end of the day. And Peter, I just want to ask you, throw it over to you. Go ahead and kind of respond to what I said. You know, what has been your experience, and what are you doing as you're about to get back in the airplane on your fourth season to kind of keep you in the right mindset?
I'll be honest with you. I'm pretty scared to get back in, not just with being out of it for 4 months and getting back in the airplane, but seeing all of the fatalities. I am pretty nervous about getting back in, but you know, for me, I'm just gonna take it slow, which is gonna be real difficult, because the urge is going to be there to go as quickly as I can, make up for the last 4 months that I've had off and I've missed. And that's going to be real hard to overcome. But I think one of the big things I'm going to do is just take my time.
Yeah.
And, take my time, not really worry about getting turned back around too quick. You know, and which I didn't have a lot of trouble with before, you know, trying to make too tight of turns. You know, I usually have a set number that I go to out for my line, and that's when I turn. You know, I don't try to set a record.
Right.
You know, so I guess taking my time would be a big one, and definitely try to eliminate as many distractions as I can. I bought a helmet, and it has Bose in it, which is very nice. And it's nice to listen to some music sometimes, but you know, if I can manage without music, I will do it.
Yeah.
Really the only reason I listen to music is to keep my mind off of getting sick, because I'll be the first to tell you, I get air sick a lot.
Okay.
And, I'm a crop duster, you know, so I listen to music to, I feel like the distraction of being sick is more of a bigger distraction than the music itself. So
right.
If I know it's rough and bumpy and hot out, I'll immediately just turn some music on lightly in the background just to kind of keep my mind off of getting sick, because that's what I'm thinking about, is getting sick, you know. But if at all possible, you know, when it's, I try to keep the distractions to a minimum, which would mean if I could handle it without listening to the music, and I think I could make it and not get sick without listening to music, I'll try to keep it off, you know. And then, of course, you know, any other distractions I can try to keep off of myself, you know. Different people on the ground, that's always a distraction, because I think it's human nature for us to want to show off.
Yeah.
To say, hey, look at me. So that's always a struggle, but, you know, try to keep those distractions to a minimum. It's kind of difficult when you can't control people on the ground.
Yeah.
I would say take my time, eliminate distractions. And, you know, one of the things I'm doing, and this would be for a safety standpoint too, since I'm coming back from 4 months of not doing anything, I'm going flying with my boss in his, in a Husky. And you know, he'll be in the back seat, and we'll go just kind of get back into the swing of things, see what it feels like. It's fly something that's small, not as much air force on the pedals, you know.
Yep.
So it's a little easier to control. Although a small tail wheel is actually a little more difficult to control on the ground with no tail wheel lock and no big fat rudder back there like a 802 or any air tractor really. But
yep.
We're going to do that as a safety. When I go back to work, which is supposed to be next week, my boss, I have a really good boss. Like, I have nothing but good things to say about the guy. He is going to have me start flying, and then probably for about the first week, we're going to probably swap in and out. You know, I'll fly half day, and then he'll fly half day, or maybe he'll fly a whole day for me if my foot, you know, I'm just not feeling.
Right.
My foot is just giving me a little bit too much pain, and it's not just from a standpoint of not wanting to tear an airplane up because I can't control the rudder because my foot hurts, but also from a, you want to be able to run that rudder so you don't die.
Right.
You know, the airplane can be replaced.
Right.
And I think a lot of times we forget that we're the ones who are not replaceable.
Right. Yeah. You made a lot of good points there. Couple things I wanted to go back to that you mentioned. I mean, you know, being able, it's very, very, very fortunate that you have the opportunity to do that with your boss, be able to switch in and switch out. Cause I don't know about you or any other pilots, but it seems like every season I need a couple good days to get, well, I mean, you need a couple good days to get warmed up to your airplane again, but you really need a couple good days to get warmed up to long days. You know, it seems like, you know, it seems like every year your stamina gets a little bit better, maybe because as we get more experienced, we're better at managing things and we don't wear ourselves out so much. But it seems like every season, those first couple long days are just brutal. Like you have a hard time staying focused. You're tired. It seems like it takes some warming up to that. And obviously you haven't had the opportunity to do that this year. So, I mean, it's very fortunate that you have that. And the other thing I wanted to go back to that you mentioned is people on the ground and showing off. I had an experience one time, my first year flying. Like you said, it's human nature. I was out one day in the Cessna, and I got a buddy that works for the county, and I saw his tractor out mowing ditches one day, and I thought, oh, man, I am going to buzz the crap out of him. I'm going to come up from behind him, and I'm going to blow his doors off. So I start lining up behind them. I was on my way back to get loaded. I was empty. And here's the thing about buzzing somebody is it doesn't even have to be buzzing somebody. I mean, anything. You let your guard down because it's not a part of your process of working a field. You know, when you see your friend going down the road, you fixate on that. And that's exactly what I did, is I just thought, my eyes locked onto that tractor, and I was like, I'm going to go buzz that tractor. I did not look left. I did not look right. But when I was descending, I thought, this is a stupid idea. And I did stop and look. And there was a wire running across the road, and if I actually descended to go buzz him, I would have went right through that thing, and who knows what happened to me. But I just had an experience. I wanted to go back to that point because I don't think we always realize, like, when you take your mind off of your job and start thinking about what somebody's looking at on the ground, you just let your guard down, just plain and simple. You quit paying attention. You're like, it's time to put on an air show. Let's do something fun. And that's when mistakes get made. That's when you try to make a hot dog turn, and instead of making it back into the field, you just come straight down. So
I agree 100%, and I have a similar story like that. I there could be so many, it seems like there could be so many things that can divert our attention and like try to distract us, I guess, you know, things that may not even be present physically right there. You know, like I got a wife and three kids, and they, sometimes the kids could be a little bit troublesome and she could be dealing with them. And, you know, you can have stress from that, which I know they're not teenagers by any means. They're small kids, but, you know, you can be dealing with family stress. That could be a distraction to you while you're flying too, you know, because it's like you said, it's diverting your attention.
Yep.
off of the task at hand, you know. And if you don't mind telling me the story here, it's kind of similar. I was in Iowa. It was my first year on cord run, and I'm in that 400, and I've got a couple hundred hours in it now, so I'm comfortable, and I'm doing a big 280 acre field, and there was a couple figures that ran crossways to the way I was running, and I saw a wire, a small wire, going through that figure, and the wire was parallel to my run, so I circled my field a couple times, made sure I knew where everything was at, saw the wire, okay, I know it's there, and I start working the field, couple loads, and I'm done with the field, and adjacent to my field, there is a Ground Rig brand soybean, and as I would turn, and there was a lot of cleanup on it, I would turn, and I'd be flying over them, and they'd wave at me sometimes, and you know, you kind of establish a relationship with people like that sometimes.
Yep.
You know, it seems like a little relationship.
Yep.
And you know, I was still doing good, staying focused, and it was cleanup pass. And everybody says that that's where they happen most, the accidents, is the cleanup pass, you know, because you're not, it's out of the ordinary, you're breaking your rhythm, you're breaking your stride.
Yep.
And man, are they ever right? Because I was doing some cleanup, I guess, and then I had to go up this figure. Well, it was kind of angled. So I come up the figure on the first angle, you know, the first part of the figure, kind of the open part, and I lay a swath down in there, do a trim up. Okay, that looks good. I pull up, do a 180, and come back around in, catch the second angle that goes up deep into the figure. Now, the figure was plenty wide because I had been crossing the figure, spraying, and I was just catching, you know, the edges of the figure, you know, going crossways to my original pattern, which obviously was crossways to this wire that I had observed earlier and knew was there. I knew it was there. And anyway, as I'm lining up, I see across the tree line that I'm going to be running up on. I see across the tree line, I see that Ground Rig, and he's facing right at me, coming along a little waterway. As soon as I saw him, that's where my focus just, it was gone.
Yep.
And it was, I was wrong at that point, and I was still way up in the air. And that was, I went wrong right there because I let my mind go to that Ground Rig. And so stupid, foolish, immature me, I start thinking, man, when I get done with this cleanup pass, I'm going to come up right over those trees. And he's going to be right there, and his perspective, I'm going to drop out of sight, and then the next thing he does, I'm going to pop up right in front of him.
Yep.
And it's going to be great. And I, so stupid, because you go to do a cleanup pass, and you should be thinking, man, what's waiting for me?
Yep.
What's waiting for me up here? What, you know, and if I would have just stopped for a split second, I would have known, oh yeah, that wire's in there, and it would have been solved. But anyway, I drop in there, and for some reason, I don't know why I wasn't low. I was probably about 15 feet in the air rather than lower. I start my spray run in there like an idiot, still not paying attention to the task at hand. Anyway, last second, I see a glint out of the right side of my window. I see a little glint, and it was just a single wire. But it was enough that who knows
yep.
what could have happened. I see this little glint, and it, you know, your mind works so fast, and immediately I go, oh, that wire, it's just that fast, you know, those
yep.
words, you know, oh, that wire. And I knew exactly where I messed up, and I yank back on it. I pull up, and I have no idea how I didn't feel anything, didn't hear anything. I had to have missed it by inches. I mean, maybe it wasn't, but I pull up out of there. Nothing happened. I'm scared to death.
Yep.
My hands are shaking, and more or less, I'm mad. I'm just mad at myself because I can't believe that I let myself do such a stupid and foolish and immature thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was kind of this little time where immaturity comes out, and it was just, I was kicking myself. I was yelling at myself, and I was mad. I'm like, Peter, how could you do that? I mean, you almost tore up an airplane. You almost hit a wire, all because you were being stupid and distracted because you wanted a ground rig driver to see how cool you are or whatever. I don't even know. You know,
yeah.
You probably wouldn't even be that impressed. And it cut me down to size.
Yeah.
It cut me down to size. And it, you know, and later that evening, I talked to our chief pilot who was up there with me, and I told him the story. He's like, yeah. He's like, that stuff will happen to you. He's like, that's good. You know, it really gives you a good mindset after that. And it, thankfully nothing got tore up.
Yep.
You know, and it just, but like you said, stuff that'll take your mind off of the task at hand is just, that's what'll do it,
yeah.
I guess. I mean, I don't want to come across as somebody who knows everything or even half of everything, because I don't. I'm a newbie, and I'm a rookie at this business. But I'm just telling you the story that happened to me, you know, and what I learned from it.
Yeah.
That was a big learning area right there.
Yeah. I feel the exact same way. I mean, I don't want to talk at anybody either and tell them what to do. We're just sharing experience here. And that's honestly what I feel like we need to do. You know, I mean, I wanted to point out that you told your chief pilot, I do the same thing with my boss. I mean, it's his airplane. And, you know, if I almost make a mistake and wreck it, I mean, he might be pretty upset that I almost made a mistake and almost wrecked it, but it's good to talk to him about that stuff, because the experienced guys, they will also have their story and they'll definitely coach you up on it. It feels good having a community where you can share, like, man, you know, I almost screwed up today. You know, no one's going to cut you down. Obviously they're going to be like, well, don't do that again. But everybody appreciates honesty. I think we do work in an industry where a good majority of people, they want you to stay safe, and I think they appreciate you sharing that stuff.
Yeah.
One more story and then we'll move on to our last topic. I was flying my Cessna and I was a long ways away from the airport we were loading off of. I was working a field. It was a mile long quarter, so it was skinny, and it had a tree row in this, a big set of trees in the center of it. So I was hopping the trees and going over to the other side. Well, anyways, as I finish my long runs and I'm about to start doing my cleanup, this air tractor starts turning directly over my field. I've got, of course, I was running north and south. He's running north and south across the road from me, and I've got to do all my cleanup passes. You know, I got cleanup passes that run east and west in the center. I'm going to make three passes along the trees and then a couple passes at the ends of my field to add wires at the end. And I couldn't get a hold of this guy on the radio. I mean, I don't think he had any idea that I was there. No clue. But anyway, so I got out of his way and I was just, you know, switching frequencies, trying to see if I could get a hold of him. Like, hey man, could you just give me a minute, 30 seconds, and I'll be out of your way. Finally, I got a hold of him and we worked it out so I could get in there and do my cleanup passes. Well, I was running low on gas and there was people out there watching me, and I felt rushed. I felt like I wanted to get out of this guy's way. You know, you know, not granted I was there first, but either way, you know, we're holding each other up at this point, and I just wanted to get out of there. So I make a pass on, I went to the north edge of my field, cleanup pass along the wire, turn back, make a cleanup pass along the trees, and then I turn over the trees and come back down on the other side. And I had my power still all the way forward, and I finish the first set of turns, I turn around and I start coming back in, and I've got quite a bit of speed. And these people were watching me, of course, and I'm kind of like, well, I got all kinds of speed, I can really make some hot dog turns here. on the south end of the field, I made my second pass along the wire, second pass along the trees, and then I was turning over the trees to go on the opposite side. And of course, that's a fairly short distance. So I pull up out of the field. I hardly made a turn away from that next pass. And I just thought, well, I got all this speed. I'm just going to eat it all up with altitude and come back down. Well, you know, they tell you in flight school that an airplane can stall at any altitude, and they're not wrong. You know, we talk about stalling in turns, but I came down so steep from my turn, I was like, I was pointed like straight at the ground. I felt like from my perspective, all I could see was earth when I came back down, and I'm like, oh God, what did I just get myself into? And I'm coming out of the sky like a rocket ship, and I start heaving back on the stick because I'm like I said, I did not see any horizon in front of me at all. And I pull back really hard, and I was probably pitched down about, I would say, 35 or 40 degrees, and that airplane buffeted. Wow. I was like, whoa. Ooh, I had to push the stick forward and neutralize, and I started pulling back, and it starts shaking again. I'm like, good grief, what am I going to do? You know, I'm still headed towards the earth, and I had to ride that line out because I had actually broken the critical angle of attack while I was pitched down coming back into the field. And it was just that was kind of a combination of things, but it's like, you know, I just let my guard down. I'm like, oh, I got, you know, people watching me, and I got some guy that wants me to get out of his way, and I'm running low on fuel and all these things. And it's just like, man, you know, wouldn't have mattered who was watching, what guy was held up, or if I ran out of fuel, but if I would have wrecked that airplane. So,
it's so hard. And I don't mean to get too far off here, but I feel like this might go with it. But, like, we have so much responsibility. You know, we have all that freedom, but we have so much responsibility, you know, because there's nobody. I mean, our boss is looking out for us as much as they can, and other pilots, too. But, you know, if we wreck and we die, you know, chances are they're going to have another airplane very soon and another pilot.
Yep.
And the world's going to go on. Yep. And it's not going to matter. It's not going to matter how cool your turn looked or, you know, how fast you went and all that. If you're dead, because what matters is that you're gone, you know, and you're not there anymore. And, as like, you know, as much as we like to say, you know, they'd be at my funeral and this and that, but the fact remains is that life goes on, and they're gonna, you know, that's what insurance is for. They're gonna have another airplane, and they're probably gonna have another pilot before the dirt is settled on you. You know, there's nobody looking out for us except for us,
right?
You know what I mean?
Going back to how I originally started us on this topic, one thing I have done this year to keep my head out of the weeds is I got to go to Wyoming, and that was a very, very, very educational experience for me, flying at high altitudes, high density altitudes, high temperatures, in a very underpowered 402. You know, I got there, and I was just like, I really have not flown a full day yet this year, and we were going to be, and I just thought, you know, what if I screw up today, what am I leaving behind? I thought about, I don't want my parents to go to my funeral at all. I do not want that. I want to go to my parents' funeral. That sounds horrible, but I don't want to change the order of succession here. And I think about, you know, I'm supposed to be getting married in September. I mean, I want to be at my wedding, you know?
Yeah.
I want to be at my wedding. I know. I mean, I've got a house with my fiance now. It's like, I can't imagine what I would do to her and the amount of stress that would be. I mean, obviously besides the fact that I'm gone, but just the material and physical stress of having to do all of this life on her own now, it's crazy to think about. But that's the, like you said, you know, that's the thing about this industry is you cannot lack personal responsibility because you are personally responsible for everything that happens in your airplane. We're at an hour and a half now. Do you still got a little bit of time?
Go ahead, shoot.
Okay, well, I don't want to leave your 301 story out because I'm interested in hearing about it too. So I just like I coaxed Travis into telling us a story on episode number 3, I talked Peter into it as well. He's got a story about a 301 that quit on him. So tell us a little bit about your incident and maybe some things we can take away from it.
I started in a air tractor 301 in Kansas, and that was my first ag seat. I flew without event for most of the season until August 28th. I hadn't had any trouble besides just your general radial engine garbage, fixing an oil leak or something, or adding. I mean, it was very common to add 2 gallons of oil every morning if you ran all day. And, you're always fixing an oil leak or fixing broken exhaust. And anyway, we were working in the middle of a bean run, and we were working out of Hutchinson Airport, the Hutchinson Regional Airport there northwest of Wichita. And we're swamped with beans. We're running, let's see, 6 or 7 turbines. We got a couple 602s helping. And then, of course, me, the little radial. But I was just happy to have work because we'd been in a drought, but yep. Got rain later and we were saved by a bead run. So we're working on this bead run, and I've been working most of the morning, and it was probably around 1 or so in the afternoon. We go out and I'm working out west of Hutchinson, way out there. And I mean, it's good flying out there. They got good flying, and I'm working. I get my load off. I'm headed back. I'm kind of miserable that day because it was just hot and bumpy. And the air conditioner, that thing, didn't work very well. And, okay, I'm going to go off topic here and complain. I don't know why Air Tractor did this. And I don't think they really changed it at all on the new ones either. The 802, I think, the same way. But they just added another latch on that door. But the leading edge of the door, there's nothing to deflect the wind over the edge of that door.
Yep.
So the wind is constantly trying to get under that lip. And on the 301, it only had one latch, and it was on the top.
Yeah.
So once you got going, that door would start bowing out.
Yeah.
And it would pump in more hot air. It would sort of pump in just as much hot air as cool air was coming in from the AC, which didn't work very well anyway.
Yeah.
So I was hot and tired, bumpy, and I wear a fire retardant flight suit. And I've worn them ever since I started, and still do. Of course, now it's a lot better because we run factory air conditioners in, the 802 and everything, which is nice. But in that airplane, it was a little rough. And so I was hot, bumpy, headed back to get another load, and I was probably about 1,000 foot AGL, maybe 900. I like to fly. I like to ferry pretty high, and most of our ferries in Kansas were average 20 miles, so you might as well get up. So I was about 1,000 foot, empty, headed back, and all of a sudden, it just quit. It was like I pulled the mixture. It just quit. Silent. Got quiet real quick.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you where I made the first mistake was before that. The first mistake I made in there was I didn't have my head in the game. Like we were talking about earlier, didn't have my head in the game. When you're in private pilot training, and really through all pilot training, they talk to you about, okay, always, everywhere you go, make sure you have somewhere to go. Make sure you have somewhere to put that plane down. Have an out. Always have an out. And they teach you that. And you follow it, but then you get into the ag, and you just get to that rhythm, and it flips your mind sometimes. And yep. At that point, it was definitely slipping my mind. Now, fortunately, I'm in the middle of nowhere, Kansas. Well, in the middle of nowhere is pretty much all of Kansas, in my opinion. But anyway, I don't want to slip into that. There's lots of places to go there.
Yeah.
And very flat, lots of straight, long, flat roads. And I'm flying along, and if I'd have been 2 miles closer to the airport, there'd have been a 4-lane divided highway, which would have been perfect. And I could have just lined up, got in sync with traffic and just put it down right on the highway, no problem. But I wasn't. I was 2 miles short of that. So it was a two-lane highway, very wide, not a lot of traffic, but I wasn't going to risk. I wasn't going to risk hitting a car because that wouldn't be good. So I start looking for somewhere because I didn't have anywhere because I wasn't prepared. I'm going to admit that right off the bat. I wasn't prepared. I start looking for a place and I find a road and I start turning towards the road. So now that I've turned towards this road, I tried to bring it back with the wobble pump, but you're like leaning over because that wobble pump is so far down there. You're leaning over, trying to run the wobble pump and trying to fly at the same time. And I guess there was a guy in World War II that did it with like a P-47 and he went all the way back from Germany. But it's like, if I go down here, I'm not going to POW again. So I was like, I'm not going to worry about it. And at that point, I was about 500 feet and I was like, you know what? I just got to get this thing on the ground. Forget trying to restart it because I'm losing altitude. I need to just focus on the task at hand. And I come around to the road, kind of parallel the road, make a little downwind and start turning in. I come up short and, you know, I tried to stretch the glide and I bounced real hard, touched down on the road, but I was kind of at an angle.
Yep.
You know, I wasn't slipping or anything. It's just, I couldn't get lined up with the road because I was still turning to get lined up with the road. And I was like, you know what? If I try to keep turning like this, I'm going to cartwheel it, and that's not good.
Yep.
So I just rolled the wings level, and I was like, I'm just going to set it in wings level, and at least I won't, you know, cartwheel. So I touched down on the road, bounced really hard. When I bounced back up, of course, before I bounced, I was really out of airspeed. And then after I bounced, it was, I don't know how slow I was. I was real slow.
Yeah,
which meant I couldn't keep that wing up, and the wing started falling. Right wing fell, caught the beams alongside the road, and it was a glorified ground loop was all it was. Yeah, but it was enough to collapse the left gear and catch the prop, and then the wing, and enough to total it. And that's pretty much the statement I gave the FAA or the NTSB investigator. You know, I just said, you know, I come up short, but the real reason it all happened is because my engine quit. You know, it wasn't because I was out. It wasn't because I ran out of fuel. I had 20 some gallons of fuel. So I had just over half an hour's worth of fuel. So I was legal.
Yep.
I was not being stupid. I was faring well above 500 feet. And I definitely didn't hit a wire. Wasn't showing off. Wasn't doing anything. I was just minding my own business.
Yep.
And, anyway, there were some mistakes I made. Leading up to that, though, I could have taken a field. There was lots of fields.
Yep.
But 3 weeks prior to that was my buddy and mentor, who he had a Garrett thrush quit him up in Minnesota, quit him on takeoff. He dumped his load, went across the road and put it down in full standing corn and flipped it on its top. And it was just because he had just before that load stitched down his shoulder belt that he didn't break his neck when he flipped over, because it was so tight.
Yep.
He didn't break his neck when it flipped over on the top. So all that's running through my head pretty fresh, you know. That's running through my mind as I'm trying to think, you know. I'm like, man, if I put it down in the field, there's a good chance I could flip this thing over and I could die, you know. And so that's running through my head. So that's why I chose the road. No wires, no signs. Definitely no cars. I mean, it was a wide open road. And one of the mistakes I made, which I think this is vital for anybody in any airplane, is you need to know what that airplane glides like. Mm-hmm. And I never really did that. And that was my shortcoming. I should have, sometime in the past before that, I should have done some engine out practice.
Yeah.
You know, figure out just how awful that thing glides. because it glides like a rock. You got all that drag out there with that big fat motor.
Yep.
That was my first mistake, was not being prepared. Now I am prepared. You know, the 802 on timber, I was ferried to an airport and I gave myself 9,000 feet. I got over the airport, pulled the power back and feathered it. And I just wanted to see what it felt like to fly a feathered airplane, see how good it glides, and it glides very well.
Yeah.
And it was a nice big runway, no traffic, no wind, so it was very controlled. Not a controlled situation, but it was a very good situation to try an engine out. And the engine was still running.
Yeah.
It was just the prop was feathered, you know, and I had lots of runway, and I made sure that I did not cause an emergency there. And I come in and I just saw how it would glide and come in, and I was like, this looks really good. And I brought it in. I had to actually slip it a little bit because it glides so stinking well that, yeah, I pushed the nose over. I was like, wow, I'm really picking up some speed. I had to slip it, and I come in, made a real beautiful landing there. I did that as a practice just to see what it would be like if that engine ever quits, of what it's like to fly a feathered turbine and what to expect, you know. And I think that's important. You know, I would say that you should go out and pull the fuel and shut it off, because I think you kind of create an emergency when you do that. Sometimes, you know, if you were to do that, I wouldn't do it, at least not with an airplane that expensive. I would being prepared, and I wasn't prepared in the 301.
Yeah.
And then second of all, I really try not to overestimate my airplane anymore, because I overestimated my airplane then. I was like, yeah, I could glide there. I could make that, no problem. And then I started turning. I was like, yep.
Yeah.
I made a mistake. I overestimated my airplane.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, I guess, you just have to learn. You know, so those are some of the valuable lessons I learned from that.
Matt Peed's biggest point from our second episode is just getting to know your airplane. I mean, there's a lot to learn about an airplane. I mean, especially even, like I said, with my experience last week in Wyoming. I mean, I basically had to relearn my airplane at altitude. But either way, good takeaways that I'm getting from your story. You know, I was very fortunate to have a excellent initial ag instructor. Big shout out to him, because he drilled that into my head the entire time we were doing dual and a Citabria, and he was just like, all day long, take off, your engine quits, where are you gonna land? You know, and we'd ferry to a field and he'd kill my engine twice, and then we'd be, you know, working a field and it's like, okay, engine quit, what are you gonna do? You know, on the deck, in a turn in ferry. And you know, your story can still be in a testament to Fly Five and Stay Alive, because not only are you staying above the traffic and above the towers, but any altitude you have in ferry is time. It's distance. You can make a lot better scenario, or you can put yourself in a lot better position having altitude and time to make a decision. It's little things when stupid things like your radial engine quitting on you that could make a huge difference. I mean, at 500 feet, it might not have been a road. You know, like in Kansas and even up here in North Dakota, we're very fortunate. Like you said, I mean, there's plenty of places to land. But there's a lot of other folks around the country that don't have that luxury. And you've got to make a much more difficult situation work. Small fields, trees everywhere, wires everywhere. I mean, you name it. So really appreciate you sharing that story with us. And oops. Okay, well, whatever. I accidentally hit the wrong button, but I think we should still be good. Anyways, that's the right button I'm looking for. I got to start my music up, and then I'll thank you for being on, and we'll head out from there. So,
okay.
And then you know, I can just you don't have to get off the phone right away. If you want to chat for a second afterwards, you can just stay on and chat a little bit. So let me see here. All right, I think we're at a pretty good point. So all right, well, thank you very much, Peter, for coming on the podcast and sharing all your experience with us. I learned a lot from our conversation. I hope other people did too. So thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning into the Ag Aviator Podcast. Sorry it's been a while. Obviously, summer started, so things are happening. Everybody, please stay safe out there. We will see you next time.